This is one of our Legacy of the First World War lunchtime lectures, and we're very pleased today to have Jonathan Black from King's University here to talk to us on the war artists and promoting the RAF through war art. So please, if you could welcome Jonathan Black.
Thank you very much, Harry, for asking me to speak today. Very much looking forward to talking for the next 45, 50 minutes about two artists about whom I've done a lot of work and for whom I have a great deal of affection. This is Sidney and Richard Carline. As Harry mentioned, I'm at Kingston University. I'm a senior research fellow in history of art. My PhD, 14, 15 years ago, looked at the image of the Tommy in the war art of three of Sidney and Richard's contemporaries. And this is C.R.W. Nevinson, Eric Kennington, and Charles Sargent Jagger. So I sort of moved from the earthbound Tommy to his airborne incarnation in the work of Sidney and Richard. Now, Sidney was the actual pilot who's on the far side there on your left. And Richard, he'd been commissioned into the RFC as an observer, wireless operator. So Sidney was the pilot, and actually he proved to be a very competent pilot of that fearsome machine, the Sopwith Camel. So to Sidney, he once said that flying was like the most irresistible intoxication. So recalling his wartime experiences in 1918 for a magazine article 3 years later, Sidney Carline described climbing into his single-seater Sopwith Camel fighter and at a vertiginous speed above the rich, dark Italian earth as a sensation, an exhilaration that was like nothing on earth. Flying is intoxicating, like strong drink. So those who knew and admired Carline and his brother later, such as artists Paul Nash, Mark Gertler, Duncan Grant, C.R.W. Nevinson, who I mentioned earlier, and Henry Lamb, thought that Sidney was the most unlikely fighter pilot, gentle, softly spoken, and restrained of manner. It's evident that his superior officers in Italy, such as the Canadian fighter ace William Billy Barker, VC, thought him a daring and above-average flyer, a man who never seemed to show any, and I quote, anxiety or trepidation in the cockpit. It is telling, though, that Barker, before leaving as the CEO of Carline's squadron in Italy, that the chap he referred to as the fighting painter, while brave enough, lacked, and I quote, the killing edge. Carline was one of those pilots who so enjoyed flying and hurling their machine around the sky to test the limits of its performance that he often seemed to forget he was in the air to seek out and locate enemy aircraft and shoot them down. So, who were these two? Sidney William Carline was born August 1888 in London into a family of artists. His father was the modestly successful academic genre painter, George Francis Carline. His mother, Annie Nay Smith, was an accomplished amateur painter in watercolours. And when Sidney was aged about four, in the early 1890s, the family moved to Oxford, where they would live until the spring of 1914. He had three siblings, his elder brother, George Reginald, who was thought to be the real brain box of the family, and he would go on to be into a distinguished academic career after studying archaeology and anthropology at Exeter College, Oxford, and then became a junior curator at the Pitt Rivers Museum in Oxford. Then his younger sister, Hilda, and younger brother, Richard, also grew up to become accomplished artists. And possibly Hilda was thought to be the most talented of the three, though she made the mistake of marrying Stanley Spencer in 1925, which no woman on any day should have done. But they married in 25 and separated in 35 and divorced in 37. Sidney initially studied at Oxford Preparatory School, where he revealed a precocious talent for drawing. And between 1900 and 1904, he was a pupil at Repton Public School in Derbyshire, where he continued to shine as an innately talented artist. In his last 2 years at Repton, he twice won the school drawing prize. He had to leave Repton earlier than expected as his father suffered one of his periodic financial crises. And George Francis was also unhappy that Sidney had already decided he wanted to become a professional artist, whereas he often maintained that it was his younger brother, Richard, who was the most talented in the family, with more drive and ambition, and consequently he deserved to be given financial help in attending an art school. So Sidney, I think, sort of first came he first attended the Slade School of Art, and I think Sidney's entire approach to art was transformed by meeting the University College London art historian Roger Fry, and he was bowled over by the famous first post-impressionist exhibition held in London in November 1910, curated in part by Fry along with the writer Desmond McCarthy. Henceforth, Sidney, and to a lesser extent Richard, moved within Fry's orbit while always remaining on the fringes of the celebrated Bloomsbury Group, to whom Fry belonged and which Fry acted as paramount theorist and aesthetician. In November 1911, Sidney was elected, probably thanks to his father's influence, to the Oxford Art Society, and thereafter would exhibit regularly with that body. And then just before the First World War, he started as a prolific medal designer and maker. And this medal, rather charming medal here, of the connoisseur Viscount Dillon, was commissioned by the then director of the National Portrait Gallery in 1913. After leaving the Slade School of Art at UCL in 1911, Sidney spent about 18 months studying in Paris at an art school run by a slightly eccentric Canadian called Percival Tudor Hart. You knew that he was an interesting time with him, because he spelt his first name Percyval, and rather than the usual Percival. And it was through Tudor Hart that Sidney had his first introduction to German Expressionism, in particular the watercolours and prints of the great Expressionist Wassily Kandinsky, the towering talent and founder member of the Munich-based Der Blaue Reiter group of Expressionist artists. Now, some of Sidney's sketchbooks have survived from 1913-14, and they suggest that he was primarily interested in rural life, but there are a few images indicating an interest in the world of the air and of exploring the air. And there's a couple of rather charming sketches of a dirigible on the outskirts of Oxford in the sketchbook just before the First World War breaks out. So in the late spring of 1914, Sidney returned to Britain from Paris and to the new family home at 47 Downshire Hill in Hampstead. And by now he was beginning to establish a reputation as a gifted maker of portrait medallions in plaster and bronze, as I showed you with the rather charming medal of Lord Dillon, but also as a talented topographical etcher. He produced a series of etchings of Oxford sites between 1911 and 1914, and a creator of austerely attractive landscape studies in watercolour, charcoal and pastel. And in the summer of 1914, so just before the outbreak of the First World War, Sidney found a position as art master at Rossall's, a public school at Fleetwood in Lancashire. His teaching duties indeed had just begun when, out of the blue, as Richard, his brother, later recalled, Britain declared war on Germany on the 4th of August 1914. And the Carline family thereafter was significantly divided over the war and whether it could be regarded as a just cause. George Francis, the father, regarded hostilities between the great powers as a calamity for civilization and did not want to see his sons becoming involved at all. Annie, the mother, and Nancy, Hilda, who were both convinced Christian Scientists, were strongly inclined towards pacifism. So the mother and the sister didn't really want Sidney and Richard to become involved. Poor health, meanwhile, prevented George Reginald, the eldest brother, from volunteering. Richard, a great admirer of German culture, and particularly Nietzsche, thought it best to wait and see and was in no hurry to volunteer. As for Sidney, he was probably politically the most conservative of the Carlines. He was never openly critical of the British Empire, as his parents and siblings could be on occasion. And in the summer of 1915, he greatly surprised his family by resigning from his position at Rossall's as a schoolmaster. He bought himself a second-hand motorbike and took a mechanics course with an aim to eventually volunteer as an army dispatch rider. Sidney apparently revelled in the feeling of speed as he drove up and down Haverstock Hill at, and I quote, according to his father, a reckless velocity of 40 miles an hour. And then in late January 1916, Sidney volunteered for the army, closing days of the Derby scheme, right at the end of January 1916. So it's about 5 weeks before conscription was introduced for men aged between 18 and 35. So then a contact that he'd made through Roger Fry earlier in the war, and this was Winston Churchill's private secretary, Edward Marsh, introduced Sidney to the writer, lawyer, and future biographer of the American painter, John Singer Sargent. This was a man called the Honourable Evan Charteris, who at the time was a staff captain at the Royal Flying Corps headquarters in London. And Charteris suggested when they first met early in March 1916 that Sidney seriously consider volunteering to become a fighter pilot. Now, he jumped at the idea, and Charteris smoothed his path to gaining a commission as a second lieutenant in the Royal Flying Corps. And ironically, at the time, he explained himself to his parents by saying, oh, you know, if I join the Royal Flying Corps and become a pilot, it'll be far less dangerous than going to the Western Front as an infantry officer. Which, of course, it was very different when he actually did eventually get to France in 1916. Meanwhile, Richard, not to forget him, he volunteered to become a private in a battalion of the Middlesex Regiment, in the 15th Middlesex Regiment. And a few months later, he managed to secure a commission in the Middlesex Regiment as an infantry officer. But as soon as that had come through, he was trying his best to transfer to the Royal Flying Corps to join his brother. So Sidney began his flight training early in May 1916 at the RFC's Central Flying School at Upavon in Wiltshire. But he had to confront this fearsome-looking machine, the flying birdcage, the Morris Farman Shorthorn, which is the first aircraft that he found himself on and beginning his flight training. And then from then he moved on to the Avro 504 and the BE-2C. And he survived the rigorous training process and a couple of crashes. In fact, at the time, 35 trainee RFC pilots were being killed a month in 1916. And in fact, if you look at the overall casualties for the RFC, RAF, something like just over 14,000 British pilots and air crew were killed during the First World War, and an amazing just over 8,000 died in accidents. Not fighting the enemy, but in accidents in the UK. So anyway, Sidney actually managed to survive his period of flight training and was awarded his wings late in July 1916 after accumulating just over 21 hours of solo flying. And then early in August 1916, he was posted to number 19 squadron in France, which was equipped with a version of the BE-2, the BE-12 fighter bomber, flying missions in support of British infantry over the Somme battlefield. And by now he could boast just over 36 hours of solo flying experience, which was actually more than most young pilots who were being posted to France at the time, which was somewhere between 14 to 15 hours of flight experience. Early on the 31st of August 1916, Sidney flew his third operational mission, a bombing raid on German positions in Hautvilliers Wood and during the Somme campaign. He dropped his bombs and later recalled that he was flying back to the British lines when he became engrossed by the beauty of the sunrise at 10,000 feet. However, he'd allowed his concentration to wander, which proved to be an almost fatal mistake, as he was jumped from out of the sun by three or possibly four German LFG Roland C-2 fighters. Now, Sydney was an above-average pilot, and even flying an obsolete death trap such as the BE-12, he managed to outfly and evade at least two of his attackers, but machine gun bullets from the third hit his machine, and one of the bullets slammed into his upper left thigh. He crash-landed behind British lines and recalled that he somehow managed to stagger away from the wreckage before it went up in smoke. He thought it was truly miraculous that he did not go up in smoke himself, as he had been drenched in petrol from a ruptured petrol tank. He crawled about 50 feet from his machine, now burning fiercely, and hoped not to be hit by shrapnel from exploding ammunition before he fainted from loss of blood. Here he is, convalescing from his leg wound in Tunbridge Wells, exotic Tunbridge Wells in Kent. There he remained for 2.5 months until early November 1916. Meanwhile, Richard, by November 1916, was a second lieutenant in the RFC, hoping to work on aerial camouflage with Percival Tudor Hart in a farm in Bewley in Hampshire. And he was hoping that Sydney would be, once he'd recovered, would be able to join them and to work on these early forms of aerial camouflage. An RFC medical board, early in January 1917, passed Sydney as fit for home service duty only, and then he was posted to a reserve squadron where he flew a variety of aircraft camouflaged by his old art teacher Percival Tudor Hart, now being helped by his Sydney's younger brother Richard. And Percival Tudor Hart was advising a somewhat sceptical RFC about the merits of various innovative camouflage schemes related to his sort of pre-war expressionism. So early in December 1917, Sydney was reassigned to another reserve squadron, this time to learn to fly the fearsome F1 Sopwith Camel, a design so tricky to fly that it killed at least 350 trainee RFC pilots in 1917 alone. It was an inherently unstable machine with an alarming tendency to go into a fatal, near-fatal, right-hand spin, but in the hands of a skilled pilot, proved superb for close-quarter dogfighting. Indeed, it would emerge as the most successful British fighter design of the First World War, responsible for shooting down at least 1,300 enemy aircraft. Now, as I said, Sydney was an above-average pilot and took to flying a Camel with aplomb. He seemed so at ease with the machine that later in December 1917, he was temporarily posted to fly in an extremely hazardous night fighter role, stalking German Gotha G4 bombers, making nocturnal raids on London and the southeast of England. And Sydney flew over a dozen missions, but never actually saw a Gotha bomber, and later expressed his amazement that he never crashed while trying to land complete darkness. Now, meanwhile, in Italy, at the end of October 1917, 7 German and 26 Austro-Hungarian divisions attacked the Italian army at the northern end of the Gorizia front near the small village of Caporetto, now called Kobarid, in Slovenia. Within 24 hours, 3 Italian armies were in full retreat westwards. By mid-November 1917, they'd fallen back over 70 miles and formed a defensive position along the west bank of the River Piave. The Central Powers are now less within 20 miles from St. Mark's Square in Venice. And so, understandably, the Italian government made an impassioned plea to the British and the French for military help. And early in November 1917, a British-Italian expeditionary force, the IEF, consisting of 5 infantry divisions commanded by General Sir Herbert Plumer, began to arrive behind the Italian front lines. And Plumer had insisted his force be given adequate air support. He arrived at his HQ in northern Italy to find the skies all above dominated by German and Austro-Hungarian aircraft. So he was initially provided with 5 RFC squadrons. 3 are fighters, the 28th, which was the squadron that Sydney would join in February 1918. Then there was the 45th and the 66th. So these 3 fighter squadrons were equipped with Sopwith Camels. And then there was 2 recon and bombing squadrons equipped with RE8s, the Harry Tate, and that's the 34th and the 42nd. So this came to a total of about 90 operational aircraft. Towards the end of March 1918, with the Germans launching a massive offensive on British lines in France, the Kaiserschlacht, Plumer was ordered to return to France to retake command of the Second Army in Flanders, and his place as CNC of the British Italian Expeditionary Force was taken by an intelligent and forceful Anglo-Irish aristocrat who was highly thought of by Field Marshal Haig, and this was General Sir Frederick Rudolph Fatty Lambert, 10th Earl of Cavan. He was even keener on the battlefield potential of air power than Plumer had been. The departing Plumer was accompanied by one squadron of the Campbells and one of the RE8s. However, the Earl of Cavan insisted that he be given in return a squadron of the versatile Bristol fighter. This was the 139 Jamaica Squadron, so called because many of the aircraft had been paid for by the Jamaican Planters Association. So by April 1918, the new RAF, because the RFC had become the RAF on the 1st of April 1918, the new RAF in northern Italy, this is the 14th Wing, had an effective strength of about 70 aircraft. As for Sydney, he was much relieved in mid-February 1918 to be posted to the 28th Squadron in Italy with their Sopwith Camels, and he was based at a rudimentary airfield outside the small hamlet of Poggio, which is about an hour northeast of the Italian city of Vicenza. He settled into a routine of flying escort missions for RE8s, taking photographs of enemy positions, and also forward patrols looking for the enemy to attack. His flight commander and then temporary squadron leader was the famed Canadian ace William Billy Barker, already established as an ace and as a fire eater. He eventually notched up over 40 kills. He made it clear that the task of the squadron was to dominate the airspace over Italy, as British troops on the Western Front habitually sought to dominate the no man's land in front of their trenches. And by late February 1918, Sydney was flying 2 to 3 missions a day, about 2 hours each duration, over the Austro-Hungarian lines. So each mission lasting between an hour and a half and 2 hours. I love the fact that he called his Sopwith Camel, he had three of them, and they're all called Prudence 1, 2 and 3. As he was to write to his younger brother Richard in March 1918, that Richard was based with the RFC, in London, he found that constant flying at 20,000 feet rather took it out of you. He said that flying at 20,000 feet, which they did on a regular basis, rather took it out of you. It's clear now that he was suffering from the effects of oxygen starvation or hypoxia, common amongst all pilots regularly flying without oxygen over 10,000 feet. You really should have oxygen from. And the symptoms included headaches, eye strain, and respiratory problems. In his letters home, Sydney very much focused on the novelty of his surroundings. He'd never been to Italy before, sketching the typical local North Italian landscape he could see from the windows of his billet. As I said, he sketched British and French troops with Italian civilians that he saw seen strolling together in the main street of the hamlet, and ruefully mentioned semi-farcical attempts to communicate with the local people, despite the fact that he'd arrived in Italy with a specially purchased Italian phrase book. He made light of the heavy enemy anti-aircraft fire, which was something of an Austro-Hungarian speciality he had encountered, and played down the fact that his machine had twice been hit. And I quote, "Till just recently, things have been very quiet, except for the usual plodding through Archie bursts, which is not too nice. I've had several bits of Archie through my machine, but nothing at all serious. I'm thinking of doing a picture of the subject." And this would eventually become one of the first works he painted as an official war artist later in 1918. What he was careful not to mention, so as not to alarm his family, especially his mother, was that as a result of his camel being hit by some of the Archie fire, in the last days of February 1918, he twice crashed trying to land his aircraft at the 28th Squadron's base at Poggio. He later recalled there was plenty of time to marvel at the scenery from 15 to 20,000 feet over the impressive Julian Alps or over the valley of the River Brenta. He had not seen much as yet of the enemy Imperial Austrian Air Service, handicapped by flying obsolete machines that were simply outclassed by the British Sopwith Camels. During one patrol, early in March 1918, which he later painted up as this work, as a war artist, he did administer the coup de grace to an Austro-Hungarian Albatross C-3 reconnaissance aircraft he had attacked with two other members of his squadron. He later wrote to his brother of the episode with a distinctly chilling clinical detachment, and I quote, "On patrol with two other chaps, I saw a Hun two-seater taking photos about 5,000 feet below us. We were at 10,000 at the time, and on our side of the line. We dived on him. He put up, however, no show. We first shot the pilot, and then the observer leaving over, trying to dive for home. But he was also shot, and the machine crashed into the river. There was a patrol of six or so enemy scouts at about 15,000 feet who were supposed to be escorting this machine. And as soon as they saw us go for him, they apparently turned for home in their aerodrome. But then they ran into three more of our machines, and only three of their men got back." So it's evident from his letter that the enemy Albatross was actually shot down over the River Piave. However, when Sidney came to paint the incident late in September 1918 for the Ministry of Information, he depicted the enemy craft being attacked over the much more picturesque valley of the River Brenta, which the artist thought more atmospheric and with clear Dantean overtones. Early in April 1918, he managed actually to outfly five Austro-Hungarian fighters when he was attacked after having been abandoned by mistake by his wingman as part of a two-man patrol. After the incident, he wrote to his brother Richard, "We have been doing two machine patrols lately, and this morning I took a new fellow up. On the lines we met six Italian machines, and he, of course, thought I was one of them, and followed them and promptly lost me. So I did the patrol by myself. When I saw five Hun machines come up from behind the hills quite close, I got between them and the sun. They went off along the mountains. We saw them again this afternoon, and I managed to bag one." So this was his second confirmed kill. And early in July, he would be credited third. Sidney thereafter would always say that he was half an ace. Typically with Sidney, he got it wrong in the sense that you needed five kills to be an ace, but he thought it was six. In mid-April 1918, the medical officer for the 28th Squadron judged that Sidney needed a rest. It's generally after sort of 2 months or over 100 missions of operational flying, they generally gave the pilots a break. Didn't send them home, but at least they gave them a sort of a change of duties. So he needed a rest. The medical officer thought he needed a rest from frontline operational flying, and so Sidney was posted to the 7th Aircraft Park, part of the 14th Wing of the RAF in Italy. And that was based near Padua, Padova, to test fly Sopwith Camels sent out from England in crates, some of which were to be eventually handed over to Italian pilots. This move was also proof of just how respected Sidney was as a pilot. Only the most talented and skillful ones were assigned to show off the Camels' capabilities to their Italian counterparts. However, it proved to be a curious form of rest. On one occasion, part of the cockpit, which had not been properly attached in England, suddenly broke away while Sidney was in flight. A hunk of metal hurtled backwards, hit him on the head, and temporarily knocked him out while he was flying at 17,000 feet, and he came to with his machine in a spin, having lost nearly 10,000 feet. He was able to regain control of the aircraft and even managed to provide Italian villagers watching open-mouthed below with an impromptu acrobatic display and dropped a couple of packets of chocolates on them. Rather stylish thing to do after that shock. On another occasion, the engine of his Camel, recently arrived from England, suddenly stopped dead at 5,000 feet, and Sidney managed to make a controlled crash landing on friendly territory, though moments before he did so, he narrowly missed flying into a mountainside when his machine was suddenly caught by a violent thermal current. Now, by now we're in sort of late April 1918, with Richard back in England, trying to obtain a post for himself and for his elder brother as official war artists, with the help of CRW Nevinson, who of course had by now was already a war artist and had been since July of 1917. Just to give an idea of some of the work that Nevinson was producing at the time on aerial theme. And Richard was starting to produce work such as this, which was inspired by sort of much simpler images he'd sketched as primers for observers who were learning the art of artillery spotting. Now, in mid-June 1918, Sydney had to suddenly return to combat operations as the Austro-Hungarians launched two major offensives, one across the Asiago Plateau, and then the other one, the more serious one, which was across the Piave, south of Papadopoli Island, which was called the Battle of the Solstice, which raged between the 15th and the 24th of June 1918. The Italians resisted fiercely, but were forced to give ground in places up to 5-6 miles. The Earl of Cavan ordered all his available RAF fighters to attempt to stem the Austro-Hungarian advance by bullet and bomb. And the extremely hazardous business of ground strafing, that's machine gunning infantry and dropping four 25-pound Cooper high-explosive bombs that the Sopwith Camel could carry from as low as 50 feet. Sydney only flew about 7 such missions over the 10 days that the offensive lasted, flying on occasions between 50 to 80 feet. But as he wrote at the time to his brother, he felt that these missions had aged me by over 50 years. The Austro-Hungarians had crossed the Piave with batteries and machine guns configured to fire upwards against attacking low-flying aircraft. Sidney found it, and he, as he wrote to his brother, particularly wearing on the nerves to fly directly what to appear to be a solid wall of tracer fire, and that he was, and I quote, simply amazed to still be alive. However, there was no doubt that they had put up, and I quote, the wind up brother Hun. And with the Austro-Hungarians retreating back across the river Piave on the 23rd, 4th and 24th of June, the Battle of the Solstice came to an end, a clear defeat for the attackers, unable to hold any of the initial gains made in the face of Italian infantry and Italian and British aircraft relentlessly attacking them and their supply lines. So towards the end of July 1918, Sidney's appointment as an official British war artist attached to the Italian Expeditionary Force, specifically tasked with recording the heroic deeds of the newly minted Royal Air Force, came through. The appointment was dated the 28th of July 1918. And he was working for quite a remarkable figure who's sadly now unsung, Lieutenant Colonel ACH Archie MacLean, who was the head of the RAF's visual arts subsection within the Ministry of Information's art department. Now, his brother, Richard, who had qualified in 1917, as I mentioned, as a second lieutenant RFC wireless operator, he'd already found employment as an official war artist. He spent most of August and September 1918 flying over the Western Front, making sketches that he would then work up back at the RAF guest chateau at Esdar. I think he was complaining that his hair was falling out with the strain anyway. But, as I said, the formidable Archie MacLean, ACH MacLean, who was the head of the RAF's art subcommittee, he had the ear and the support of the father of the RAF, the even more formidable Chief of the Air Staff, Sir Hugh Boom Trenchard, who was absolutely determined that the RAF's contribution to the war effort would be prominently represented in the nation's collection of war art. So, as I mentioned, by early August 1918, Richard had been posted to France as an official war artist, with a brief to record what he saw in reconnaissance fights over the much-shelled, much-battered former Somme battlefield and also the Ypres salient. So after a brief visit to London, Sidney returned to Italy early in August 1918 and quickly found a studio in Vicenza's Municipal Museum on the Via Accademia. So there he is at work. While the intelligence section of the British general headquarters provided him with a motorcycle and sidecar to hold his palette and easel and paints. By late August 1918, a Sopwith Camel from 28th Squadron had been set aside for him to fly over the front looking for suitable subjects. And of course, he always flew with his twin Vickers heavy machine guns loaded, because it would seem that he was at least on two occasions, attacked by Austro-Hungarian aircraft over the Veneto, east of the Piave, when he was supposed to be making sketches for official commissions. He had quickly become aware of how difficult it was to make watercolour or even pencil or charcoal sketches while trying to fly his Sopwith Camel with his knees, not a position to be recommended given the aircraft's infamous instability. But after, you know, a few sort of hairy moments, he worked out that it was much easier to sketch from the back seat of a Bristol fighter of 139 Squadron, much safer and easier. But he found that sometimes that the water in his watercolours froze while he was trying to sketch them, and he remarked at the time to Richard that it was no fun at all trying to defrost a watercolour at 15 or 20,000 feet by breathing on the surface of the paper while dodging minute yet wickedly sharp particles of ice flying off from the paper. Sidney concluded, as Richard had already found, that the best procedure for an aerial artist was trying to make simple sketches in charcoal or pencil while airborne or immediately after having been airborne, and then aim to make a more detailed sketch for memory of a scene worthy of reproduction in watercolour and or pastel shortly after returning to Earth, usually within half an hour. Sidney later indicated he thought that preserved the vividness of a view or episode to leave it no more than half an hour after landing. Now, the RAF was expected to play its part, securing control over the airspace of the area to be attacked by Cavan's 10th Anglo-Italian Army during the last great Italian assault on the Austro-Hungarian forces in the First World War. This was the Vittorio Veneto campaign, which began on the 24th of October 1918, as Italian and British troops side by side tried to break through the Austro-Hungarian lines on the east bank of the River Piave. As Cavan's troops crossed the Piave and broke through on the 27th of October, Austro-Hungarian air bases were repeatedly attacked by the 14th Wing of the RAF. Now, Sidney actually took part in this operation, or one of these operations, on the 27th, 8th and 9th of October, flying a Sopwith Camel, so he took at least in one part in one raid on the aerodrome at Sicile by the 28th Squadron. And then a day later, he was part of a flight of four Camels from the 28th Squadron, strafing Austro-Hungarian infantry and supply wagons, attempting vainly to retreat eastwards down the road to the city of Udine on the Udine-Pordenone road. The Austro-Hungarian troops were attacked repeatedly over a 48-hour period by Camels of Sidney's old squadron and also from the 66th Squadron, and they left a trail of utter devastation over 7 miles long. The road to Udine was strewn with dead soldiers and horses and wrecked, burning motor lorries, motor cars and carts. On the last day of October 1918, he attached himself to 139 Squadron, flying the F-2B Bristol fighter bomber. Though he later recalled that he spent much of the mission attempting to make quick sketches as the pilot of his machine dived on fleeing Austro-Hungarian transport and rear echelon units, he was urged by the pilot to open fire on the enemy soldiers below with a rear gunner's Lewis gun. Sidney did this for about 20 minutes and became so engrossed in the business that he could not remember changing one empty magazine for a full one in mid-air while they were taking fire from the ground below, and also were temporarily threatened by an attack from an Austro-Hungarian aircraft, which made one of the few rare appearances during the entire 12 days of the Vittorio Veneto campaign. In all, Sidney later calculated he'd fired three whole drums of 303 ammunition for the Austro-Hungarians below, over 200 rounds, during several diving attacks, flying at over 120 miles an hour. In the last attack, his Bristol fighter was hit by an Austro-Hungarian machine gun fire from below, and Sidney's pilot was hit and seriously wounded. However, the pilot kept flying and returned the aircraft safely to its base. And also he found time to tour the parts of northern Italy which had been formerly occupied by Austro-Hungarians, and also record some of the bomb damage campaign that's been completely forgotten about now, of the Austro-Hungarians bombing Italian cities and towns in northern Italy in December 1918. But he didn't have time, much time, to sit on his laurels, because he and his brother were sent out by the formidable Archie MacLean on a sort of amazing tour at the taxpayers' expense of the Middle East, a large part of which was now to become part of the British Empire since the destruction of the Ottoman Turkish Empire. So Lieutenant Colonel MacLean sent him out with his younger brother Richard to paint incidents and episodes that reflected to the credit of the RAF component that had accompanied the Egyptian Expeditionary Force under Allenby fighting the Turks. So he was sent out with the backing of Boone Trenchard and also with an enthusiastic reception of the senior RAF officer in the Middle East, the future Air Vice Marshal Sir Geoffrey Salmond, and also with the encouragement of the senior RAF officer in Mesopotamia, Edward Tennant, and the British governor of Jerusalem, Sir Ronald Stores. And they arrived, yes, mid-January. They spent about 3 months, February to April, sketching in Palestine, Syria and Lebanon. They'd arrived at Ramla in Palestine with No. 1 Royal Australian Air Force on the 23rd of January 1919. Sidney noted in his diary from the time, "We were given a small bell tent. The Australians were good-hearted and hospitable, though they do rather make a fetish of their roughness." Early February 1919, he was in Jerusalem, and Sidney later recalled for the London Evening Standard that while trying to sketch over the city, his pilot suddenly dived to avert an, and I quote, "an expected massacre of the Jews. He kept diving to scatter the crowds, who had a habit of first fighting amongst themselves and then eventually combining to attack the British, who were attempting to maintain order." So by mid-February 1919, Sidney was sketching a scene of devastation in the Wadi Farah, which is now part of the Palestine National Authority, which is where British fighters had relentlessly strafed soldiers of the retreating Ottoman 7th and 8th Armies on the 21st of September 1918. And during 4 hours, British SE-5s and Bristol fighters on that occasion fired over 50,000 rounds of ammunition and dropped over 9 tons of bombs on the retreating Turkish troops. At least 90 artillery pieces, 50 motor lorries and over 1,000 carts plus hundreds of men were destroyed in this conflagration. Sidney at the time noted that the Wadi was, and I quote, "commonly called the Valley of Death, the scene of the great aeroplane bombing exploits and the rout of the Turkish army. The road ran below the side of a steep gorge, with precipitous drops down to the Wadi running below. All along were the debris of overturned carts and motors, and lying everywhere were the skeletons of horses and even men. Their bones had been picked clean by the jackals. It was a dreary, tortured place, and the Turkish army trying to escape down it was easily massacred." Now, a few days later, after he'd made this initial sketch, Sidney and Richard were preparing to leave the area, and they took a last walk through, and I quote, "the dirty, narrow and cobble roads of Nablus." And it's interesting that Sidney noted, "as the locals are fanatical Muslims, one had rather a feeling of intruding and of not being overwelcome. And then as we left, somebody took a shot at us." So he was sort of dimly aware, enthusiast that he was for the British Empire, that we weren't exactly welcomed by the locals. Then everybody seemed to agree that we were better than the French. So that's something. Early in March, he and Richard arrived in Damascus, and Sidney was rather taken with the area, noting that this is the land of brigandage. So on the 18th of March, Sidney was sketching the former Ottoman air base at Rayak, or Rayak, in the Bekaa Valley, now in the south of Lebanon, which had been repeatedly bombed and strafed by British aircraft in late September 1918. Sidney noted in his diary, and I said, "I found the remains of the Turkish aircraft park, which had been badly bombed together with the adjoining large ammunition dump and close to the railway junction. When the Turks left the place in a hurry, they burnt all they could and left behind 30 gaunt carcasses of aeroplanes, some standing on their noses and other in all kinds of positions amid all manner of rubbish. I made sketches with a view to painting a future work. Royal engineers nearby were blowing up discarded live ordnance. The former ammunition dump being regularly raided by brigands. There has been a recent raid on the dump during which at least 40 brigands were killed. The chief of the band was famous for having withstood in his mountain fastnesses all the attempts of the Turks to capture him and his party. And now he was taking on the latest invaders, which Sidney thought was rather an impressive effort. And then by early April 1919, Sidney was back in the vicinity of Damascus, northwest of the city, sketching the site of where an Ottoman infantry column protecting a railway line had been ambushed from the air in the Wadi Barada on the 30th of September in 1918, during which time at least 4,000 Turks, were Ottoman Turkish troops, were killed. Two steam locomotives were blown up and six more were captured. So he and Richard spent much of May in Cairo waiting for a ship to take them from Port Said to Bombay. Then from Bombay they went to Karachi, and from Karachi to Basra, in what was then called Mesopotamia. They arrived in Baghdad on the 24th of June 1919. And Sidney was able to fly on some of the sketches of Damascus. And also Richard was painting, not to forget him, he was also flying over Palestine in particular, and produced a series of rather sort of delightful schematic images of Gaza, Jerusalem, which is in the RAF Museum's own collection, Damascus from 10,000 feet. And then by the time they got to Baghdad, here's Richard painting Baghdad from 10,000 feet in late June 1919. And Carline had also got access to an aircraft, so he's flying over former battlefields from the First World War in Mesopotamia. He's over the rather strikingly named town of Hit on the Euphrates. Also, they're near Hilla, who's doing sketches with the Indian Army, who were the sort of main backbone of the British military presence in Mesopotamia. And these wonderful sort of images of some of the patrols over an area that was soon to rise in a huge revolt against the British in the summer of 1920. By July 1919, he and Sidney and Richard had hitched a lift to a flight of Bristol fighters operating on the outskirts of Mosul, who were flying operations against the Kurds, who had the temerity to try and create their own little state in defiance and contravention of the Versailles Peace Treaty. So in some early example of so-called air control, the Bristol fighters from the Mosul flight were used to bomb the Kurdish troops and then villages to the north and northeast of Mosul to suppress or help suppress the uprising. He later recalled in a newspaper, on one occasion, he and his brother were working in aeroplanes over the Kurdish highlands north of Mosul, where the curious sect known as the devil worshippers live. The Kurdish rebellion was very active at the time, and there were plenty of shots flying about. But fortunately, the aim of the tribesmen proved somewhat ineffective. And then they rounded off their wonderful sojourn in the Middle East with about 3 weeks in Persia. First of all in Tehran, and then they moved to the southern end of the Caspian Sea, a place called Qazvin. And they were there by the southern end of the Caspian Sea in mid-September 1919 when they received a sudden withdrawal order to come back to Britain from the Air Ministry, which I think had finally discovered that Lieutenant Colonel MacLean, in charge of the art subsection within the Ministry of Information, which was being wound up, had spent about three times the amount of money that he'd been allotted for the RF commissions. He'd been given £1,000 to pay for commissions for the RAF for artworks, and yet he'd spent nearly £3,000. So he, as in the way of these things, as he was doing it, you know, sort of for patriotic reasons, so to speak, MacLean was bumped upwards to become a brigadier general and was replaced by a wing commodore, Lamb. So Sidney and Richard returned to England in early October 1919 to attend the private view of the solo show of C.R.W. Nevinson, where he exhibited this work, just to give an idea of some of the other works that on an aerial theme that were being produced at the time. And then Sydney and Richard began to paint, you know, sort of more finished versions of some of the sketches. They had been initially been asked by Maclean to paint over 24 works to represent the RAF in the Imperial War Museum's art collection. However, there was only money left. They discovered, or Wing Commander Lamb discovered, there was only money left to commission 7. So rather than the 24 that they were hoping to get, they only got 7. 4 by Sydney, including this one of the destruction of the Turkish town transport at Wadi Farah, and 3 by Richard. These works have been painted. The 7 that they, the sevens of official commissions, were exhibited in the huge Nations War Pictures exhibition held at Burlington House from December 1919 to February 1920. So Sidney displayed the 4 works that he'd painted up as official commissions, plus 5 sketches from his more recent Middle Eastern sojourn. They received both his work and the work that his brother had painted in the Middle East were received very positive and admiring critical comments. And he and his brother further secured their reputation as the nation's leading, and I quote, intrepid painter airmen, with a joint exhibition at the Goupil Gallery in London on Regent Street in April 1920. They also had a joint exhibition of their work in Cambridge on Trumpington Street in the summer of 1920. Then they had a further joint exhibition of their work from Italy and, or from Sydney's work from Italy and the Middle East, and of Richard's work from the Middle East at the Manchester City Art Gallery in April, May 1921. And then their work went off to North America to be exhibited in 3 venues in Canada, in Ottawa, Toronto, and Winnipeg, and 2 venues in the United States, Chicago, ending up with Washington, D.C. But I don't run out of time to go into the response, but very interesting response in North America to these images displaying the potential for air power and their use, particularly in the sort of the vast swathes of the Middle East, which had now become part of the British Empire. I'm just showing here an example of a sort of work that Sidney was doing immediately after the war. He had his first post-war holiday in Italy with his family, with his Richard's and Hilda and his parents, for about 6 months, second half of 1920. And then early in 1922, he was appointed Master of the Ruskin School of Art in Oxford. He's looking suitably cheerful. And he had time to go for a quick holiday to the Balkans to paint the Bosnia and Herzegovina. While Richard, he went back to school, he became a part-time student at the Slade from 1921 to 1924. So this is a group portrait here of the gang at Downshire Hill. Lurking on the far left-hand side is sort of a rather sheepish-looking Stanley Spencer, who would go on the next year to marry the lady in the white shirt, who's Hilda. And then Sidney Carline had a successful time at the Ruskin School of Art, but died of pneumonia aged 40, just a few days after the opening of his first solo exhibition in February 1929. And the following year, the Imperial War Museum, which was then based at South Kensington, gave him his sort of first, you know, posthumous group solo exhibition, and also by the curator of the art collection, Ernest Blakely. He'd been a great admirer of Sidney's work since the 1919 exhibition, and he wrote that he could think of no other war artist who had, and I quote, so convincingly and effectively communicated in his work the exhilaration and thrill of flying at such great heights, whose atmosphere is pure and invigorating, and where great distances are spread out in pellucid clearness. The result of his labours is a unique record and fascinating both artistically and historically. I think that comment from Blakely in March 1930 serves as a fine and a fitting epitaph, and good moment on which to finish my talk. Thank you for your attention.